Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I mean, I honestly, it's never happened to me before. I read an article and that was it. I just know that's, I'm doing that.
Bennett Miller's Oscar-nominated film, Foxcatcher, retells the tragic story of eccentric millionaire John DuPont's relationship with a pair of wrestlers, their brothers Mark and Dave Schultz.
Like anyone, they need people to look up to.
Vice's Eddie Moretti sat down with the director to discuss the movie.
Hi. So, Bennett, I kind of want to start with where we started interviewing the cast. Mm-hmm. I threw out as my first question, the first kind of theme that I want to talk about, explore, was this, you know, the presence of America in the film mm-hmm. in different ways. Mm-hmm. The film throws it into your face the whole fucking way through.
Mark, we as a nation have failed to honor you. I want to see this country soar again.
It does put its sights on a number of themes that might be particularly dynamic in our country, but not with the intention of
making a statement or commenting.
In fact, by not commenting, hopefully it permits some access past where we would normally get when we, you know, succumb to the temptation to conclude. Within this little story, you find in the nucleus of it, you know, some of these themes that might be distinctly mm-hmm. or maybe especially American that have to do with wealth and class and entitlement and exceptionalism and things like that. But it's not about condemning one side or the other. It's mostly just a film, you right. know. It's a story. You know, it's based on a true story, and with the actors and the writers. And
well, let me ask you about that, because not only is it John DuPont that's like decorating his whole fucking existence with eagles and flags right. and guns right. and tanks and stuff. But Mark, when he first comes back and talks to Dave, his brother, he's like, this guy was pulling this shit out of my brain, man. Yeah. Like, I'm yeah. thinking all these things. I yeah. think America is sliding backwards. I think we need valor and honor and all mm-hmm. that mm-hmm. stuff. So maybe it's not political. It's mm-hmm. like a psychodrama, mm-hmm. but America is a character. So what's the character?
Well, I mean, everything you just said is true and it's right. And even as you're saying that, I'm reminded of this other theme and interest, which is how it happens sometimes that people come to vote against their own interests. And, you know, how do they get sucked into something, and what is that common ground, which often does involve this sort of language and, you know, symbolism and ideologies that permit people from absolutely different walks of life. How is it that they can come together? It's another theme of the film of people who are so different, feeling mm-hmm. like they belong to each other, trying to fit together in really untenable relationships, but having mm-hmm. a mythology, like a co-authored mythology mm-hmm. that permits them to be. One of the wealthiest guys in America has some of the most talented wrestlers move onto his estate. And what is that transaction? You know, what did these guys have that DuPont wanted?
Coach DuPont has a vision. He would like Foxcatcher to be the official training site for the national team.
It's very easy to just jump to quick conclusions and simplify it, but as I researched this story over some years, it's of course it's not that simple.
What about the research for the project? Like, how did this become the thing that would, you know, take you so long to do?
I mean, I honestly, it's never happened to me before. I read an article and that was it. I just, oh, that's, I'm doing that. You know, without knowing much about it, I just...
Gut.
I was so intrigued. And to be honest, there's a part of it that was just humorous. You know, the idea of this rich guy with these wrestlers living on his estate, his enormous estate, larger than Central Park, you know, with a fence around it.
Yeah.
And he knew nothing about wrestling. And the setup is something that could have very easily been turned into a comedy.
Right, I was just going to say
tragic.
That. Yeah, yeah.
So,
but what interested you? Because you weren't going to turn it into a comedy.
First of all, there was this absurdist humor part of, like, these two worlds. I was interested in the oddity of both worlds, like the wrestling world and what's that about, and also of, you know, the super wealthy old money in this country. But again, you know, the transaction, what were these guys doing down there? And the fact that it ended horribly, another thing, and maybe this is just a personal thing, but perhaps it's also an Americana theme since we're talking about it, is people being in worlds where they do not belong and not realizing it, you know, and finding ways to convince themselves and others that this makes sense and that we do fit. And the concept of America and what it means to people, the kind of self-deception and mutual deception that has to occur, I think, for us to believe we're talking about the same thing, like America, as if it can be reduced into some simple notion.
But you're basically saying any attempt to kind of mythologize something like America into, I don't know, a structure that's like never changing and ahistorical and, you know, that's wrong, and that characters, but I'm not saying you're interested in that because you're trying to be a political scientist with this film, but I'm saying that maybe that is there and behind this film, and you're interested in how people kind of actively try and create those mythologies on a daily, you know, basis with the people that they interact with. Honestly, the shot in your film that really kind of fucked me up the most was that one shot, the insert of Washington crossing the Delaware.
Mm-hmm.
Why is that there in Mark's life?
Well, I think it's what we're talking about. It's the common ground between these classes, these forms of consciousness, that the iconography is the same.
Yeah.
And that this means something to me, and the same thing means something to you. And maybe we can be confused enough to believe that it means the same thing to both of us.
Right.
And there's also themes beneath it, meaning George Washington is some kind of a father figure.
Right.
And he was one of the founding fathers.
Right.
And these men are patriots.
Yeah.
And DuPont himself is a patron.
Right.
And these people, in fact, did not have fathers. They both saw their fathers split when they were 2 years old.
Mm.
Which is...
DuPont. What happened?
He left.
He just left.
He left for another woman. And Mark and Dave Schultz's parents split when Mark was two. And so no father. As much as founding father is Americana, there's also just that personal thing. And again, it's not ultimately the political thing that you're grabbing at,
no.
but there's a relationship between, you know, the truth of who we are behind all of these beliefs and what our conditioning drives might be, and the appeal of these things and the complications and the messiness that might lead us to be attracted to some of these ideas.
Did you in your research find that speech where Mark says he's my father, like, figure?
I spent my lifetime looking for a father, and I have found one in John DuPont.
Yes. He says, I've been searching for a father figure all my life, and I found one in John DuPont.
Is that real? Is that what he...
Those words were actually written by John DuPont.
Right.
And I found them in a book
wrote. Just out of curiosity, with the whole birds and taxidermy thing, mm-hmm. is a huge, obvious reference in film history mm-hmm. to Psycho mm-hmm. and Hitchcock.
Well, I suppose you'd call this his hideaway. His hobby, as you see, was taxidermy. Crow here, an owl there.
When you were, you know, doing that stuff, did you think of that at all or no?
No, not really.
Yeah.
But, you know, there is some measure of awareness of Hitchcock and the language of his movies. I think when they're really working at their best, you do not feel like these films are telling a story. You feel like they are observing a story, and you are not being told, and you're not just observing. You are inside someone else's head, like watching the birds. Mm-hmm. It feels like consciousness.
Why are they doing this?
Hitchcock films often had a thriller, and then there would be like a kind of family drama, kind of, especially The Birds, right, is a perfect one. But in your film, the family, right, is just not existent, or it is destroyed. And there are these moments where Dave Schultz tries to, you know, embrace his brother and bring him into a family-type experience, and they're always, like, about awkward conversations or awkward hugs. There's no familial love in there. It feels like the director is putting the family before Mark Schultz in a way to tease him and taunt him, like, you don't have this.
Because Mark doesn't feel the draw and the appeal, to him, Dave's family is sort of an inconvenience to his value system. You know, Mark is not focused on it. He says, you know, I've got my kids here, I got my wife here, I got my kids here. And he's just like, well, they can come.
Right.
You know, like they're like an afterthought. Right. His mind's not there. I heard in an interview once, I know it was Larry King, and he might have been talking to Clinton, about the effect that it had on them for not having a father, because neither of these guys grew up with fathers.
Right.
And Larry King said, I'm paraphrasing, something to the effect of, if you do not have a father, it's common to have two powerful, fundamental feelings. One is that anything is possible. And the other is an unending anxiety.
Right.
You know, and like looking over your shoulder.
What was it like creating these characters? Because they pop off as not being either of those three actors, by the way.
I did not create these characters. Mm-hmm. I mean, these people did live, and some of them still do live, and these actors, you know, did their job, and they learned these characters. But I think it's a case of casting, not just the actors, but also the story.
Right, but there's a decision by the director, to create a kind of like acting language. Let me give you an example. Mm-hmm. Pick up the kids. Mm-hmm. You see that three times in the film. Mm-hmm. You never see him pick up the kids. Mm-hmm. So you're creating the characters insofar as you're saying, guys, and even forget about the real people for a second, you're not going to express too much or in the way that in every other film, you not only see the guy pick up the kids, you see them walk down the sidewalk, then he gets in the car, and he does his hair, and then, like, you know, it's like you're, you know, squeezing the space that these actors have to create characters.
I think the actors did such an incredible job at grokking these characters and inhabiting them that you don't have to see them. You don't have to see Dave Schultz picking his kids up to know that he's a caring, loving father. It just felt redundant to see some of this stuff. You know, there's a scene when you meet the brothers together, when you see them together for the first time, where they, you know, warm up and wrestle, they practice.
Amazing scene, by the way.
Which is, the
first. Long.
Mm-hmm.
And
hardly say a word.
No, yeah.
A couple of words, just random words, in the beginning. And, right, when I assembled that scene and put it, you know, in a cut with all the other scenes, I realized there is about 20 minutes of scenes that had been shot that could be eliminated because those scenes existed in order to communicate who these guys were to each other. And it just happened that because of these actors worked the way they worked, then it was redundant.
I asked the actors, I'm going to interview Bennett on Monday. What should I know? And you know what Channing said?
Mm-mm.
You should know chess. I said, why? And he's like, because that's how he worked with us. It was a game of chess, and because you're amazing at chess, and that's
I'm not well, amazing at chess.
He thinks you're good at chess, or very good at chess, and it was for him like a glimpse into how you work. They agreed that you went into this film knowing or having an image of the dramaturgy, the drama, the scenes themselves, and sometimes the shots in your brain, but that you worked with them and threw that kind of image out. But they all said eventually kind of where you guys ended up was very close to that image that you had or that feeling for a scene. Is that true?
You can talk about the film that you're going to make. You know, I'm going to make this film, and it's going to, and this scene exists because of this, and what we're going to get from it is going to be this, and it's going to feel like this, and, you know. But that's just a conversation. That's not the scene itself.
Right.
That's sort of like that's a description of a spirit.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
That's not
a
like this lens or this, that. It's a spirit that's looking to be incarnated. And so how does that happen? Like, what's the process by which this thing that I could feel and maybe I can make you feel and see to a degree, but still is not material, what's the process that it becomes incarnated? And the process recruits these actors and their talents and obliges them to speak for these characters. The process of incarnating it did involve some exploration, and there was a certain amount that we knew, and there was a certain amount we had to admit that we did not know, and as much work had been done over the years on the script, with two very excellent and wise screenwriters, Dan Futterman and Max Fry. Still, when you get there, that's part of the process, and part of the ultimate authoring of the film is, you know, you don't stop examining, you don't stop the exploration, and so it was opened up to them, and I was curious to see how something might
evolve.
The scene that comes to mind right now is when they're on the helicopter flying to D.C. and the moment when DuPont first offers cocaine,
the kit,
to Mark Schultz. And so you have an Olympic gold medalist who is hell-bent on winning another gold for America in the Olympics that was not boycotted by the Soviets, to go to the 88 Olympics.
In Seoul.
In Seoul, and win gold, and that's the reason he's there, and that's why he was brought on, and now they're in a helicopter, and John DuPont takes out his cocaine kit and starts blowing lines and offers some to Mark Schultz. And why would somebody who has this aim to be an Olympic gold medalist partake? Mm-hmm. And I don't know if I was ever really comfortable, you know, insecure in my understanding of how that corruption happens,
right.
You know, what that really looks like, what that really feels like, what is that moment? And the actor showed me.
That was an incredible moment, but I'll tell you the other incredible moment in that scene is when he says, give it back. Mm-hmm. The way he says
it.
That's the way.
Give that to me.
Yeah. Give that to me. Exactly. Like, there is, you know, the degree of that guy's addiction by the way he says it. Mm-hmm. And again, something that the actors brought to that scene.
Yeah. And the subservience that's there. I mean, it really is a question of power. Although by the time we, you know, got to shooting the wide of them, you know, the cop car pulling up, you know, to the helicopter by the estate,
and then
that shot of the helicopter taking off. Even before we got to shooting the scene, I realized there's no way that he resists DuPont, because you see what he's being given.
That's how it strikes you as, like, it is part of getting whisked off in a, you know, $10 million chopper to, you know, travel to D.C. from Pennsylvania, which is not that far. It's there in that scene. It looks like with the hair cutting scene on the porch, listening to, I forget, amazing song now.
It's Dylan doing Woody Guthrie.
Yeah. The implication is that there was this was a 24-hour kind of obsession between the two of them. But is that true?
The film, in truth, dials back the intensity of the colorful, spectacular aspects of the story. So the cocaine use was bigger, and it went on for longer.
Why'd you dial it back?
Because then it becomes just a drug thing. DuPont's mental illness, though evident in the representation in the film, the stories were even more disturbing, you know, and it went further. But at some point, they would begin to drown out the other themes that came before it, you know, the foundation of the film.
Right.
And so it was just, you know, for dramatic expediency, it's just as much as is needed and not more.
A coach is a father. Coach is a mentor. Coach has great power on an athlete's life.
How did you get to cast Steve as John?
You know, when you make yourself a movie, all of the agencies and agents become aware that, okay, here's a movie that's going to be made, and then agents add names to the lists. And so we had, you know, our potential DuPonts, and I don't remember how many names were ultimately offered for the DuPont list. I honestly can't remember, 75, 100 names, something like that. But Carell's agent had added his name to the list. And it was not a matter of me thinking, you know who's perfect for this? It's Steve Carell. It was having Carell's name pop up on, you know, one of these lists, because it doesn't happen just once. It's sort of over time. Yeah. Like, you just ask for more names. And when his name cropped up, I just thought it was interesting, and it made a certain kind of sense. And if it could work, and I met him, and he showed me another side of himself, and he exhibited a real determination to approach this with the seriousness and commitment and devotion mm-hmm. that would be necessary for him to get a performance mm-hmm. like the kind that he gave. And that was it. It was, I just thought, well, the best version of this film is if he can pull that off, there is not a better version.
Now it's done. Mm-hmm. How does it feel?
To hear how somebody's relating to the film is the thing that makes me think, oh, right, so that's kind of part of why you do it, mm-hmm. you know? And it's really nice seeing how people,
react.
You know, take in the film.
Yeah.
And it's, again, back to the issue of the non-conclusiveness. It's not giving a message. So our conversation is, did you get my message?
Right.
Do you agree with the message?
Right.
Did I change you? Did I turn
right.
you? It's not that.
It's not that.
It's much more interesting to, even in the response of the film by people, to get, you know, to even deepen an understanding of some of the things that are at work that I think drew all of us into it in the first place. Mm-hmm.
If I'm going to say one thing about your film, I have my own ideas and interpretations, but at least it was a film that actually allowed me some space to walk into it, look around, and come up with my own ideas.
Yeah.
And most other films are just holding you by the hand and take you on a roller coaster.
Yeah.
So I want to thank you for that, because that was a gift to me. So
thank you
very much.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Thank you. That's high praise, Eddie. Thank you.
Thanks for coming.
Thank you.
Really great talking to you.